Hello and welcome to The Unique CPA with your host, Randy Crabtree. We're committed to creating a thriving community of accounting professionals who are physically and mentally healthy, fulfilled, and energized by their work. Our ultimate goal is to elevate the reputation of the accounting profession and vastly improve the lives of those in it. The Unique CPA is brought to you by Trimerit, the specialty tax professionals.
Today, our guest is Joe Woodard. Joe's a veteran of the show, actually, second time on. I'll give you a little info on Joe. Most of you probably know who he is and heard him speak before, but Joe's an author, a consultant, a coach, a speaker. He is the founder of Woodard Events, which is a training and resource organization for the accounting profession or accounting professionals. As part of his conglomerate of organizations, he is Scaling New Heights, which is a really cool conference. It's one of the largest conferences out there for the accounting profession. I'm very honored to be speaking at his event for the second straight year this year. A couple other things about Joe. I think this is his 10th consecutive year being listed as Accounting Today, top 100 most influential people in accounting. So congratulations on that, Joe. And Joe, welcome back to the Unique CPA podcast.
It's always great to be here, Randy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, there's no problem. It's always a fun conversation. Either listening to you present or having a conversation, I enjoy both ends of it. So a couple things we've talked in the past, and we've talked about all kinds of things, you know, pricing and probably business models and all kinds of things. But before we jump into really what we're going to key on today, which is a pretty cool thing, the Woodard Ideal Practice Model, any hot topics that you are running into these days or things that you're finding that the accounting profession needs to hear more than others?
Well, we need to prepare for a massive merger and acquisition activity over the next 5 years. This market's going to aggregate significantly. There are billions with a B, not millions with an M. Billions of dollars in the plural being invested by PE firms to aggregate this market. You're going to see aggregations take place around existing multi-billion-dollar corporations on the very low side. You know, QuickBooks has this low-end play. H&R Block has one, but now we've just seen that LegalZoom has created an offering under the leadership of two people who are Intuit veterans. So we've got the very small market, I would say up to about maybe 200,000 to 300,000 in sales. Pilot, you know, all of those are also entering into the space. Bezos is heavily funding Pilot. So you're going to see a lot of that become big box, buy off the shelf, mass served industries. It's a very underserved market right now. So I don't think that's necessarily a threat to accountants, as long as the accountants are doing what we've been trying to tell them to do, Randy, forever, which is to move up above that level. They need to be there anyway, where they can provide higher level valuable services. And I don't mean to disrespect anybody who's passionate about helping the startups. If that's your thing, you keep doing it. You do it uniquely. You do it in a differentiated way. You do it in a way that helps them to grow past that danger zone that is a startup. But just understand that if you're talking about record keeping for those folks, that's going to become a saturated market really fast. And it's going to be a market dominated by the gods of Olympus throwing, you know, millions of dollars of marketing thunderbolts at each other. And I don't think you want to be in the middle of that as a mere mortal. So that's going to be market aggregation number one. Market aggregation number two is going to take place in the larger space, larger being up above the, say, 2 to 3 million in revenues mark. Some of those are non-credential standalone CAS. Some of those are CPA firms. But that's where the PE money is coming in, not the multi-billion dollar existing corporations or those that have multi-billion dollar founders or investors like Bezos with Pilot, Intuit, H&R Block, and so forth. Those are already well-funded. But the PE firms are funding the inorganic growth of the top 100. And that inorganic growth is going to be done by buying dozens and then hundreds and then eventually thousands. Yes, thousands. I'm not exaggerating. Of these $2 to $5 million firms. So if you find yourself in that space where, you know, hey, I'm a $500,000 firm, I'm $1 million firm, I'm something less than 2 million, there's still going to be offers made to you, but just understand that that's not most of the money flying around in the room. And you're in a bit of a safe space combined with a danger zone, because a lot of your market's going to get gobbled up from the above you and below you. But a cottage industry, Joe's prediction, is will form. And that cottage industry is something you can thrive in there in that middle sweet spot if that is your long-term goal. So I know that was a very long answer, but I couldn't have an open-ended question like that and not point at this, Randy. It's going to change the whole profession in a way that's unprecedented. It's never happened before, and it won't happen again for another 100 years.
Yeah, I see. I told you, every time we have a conversation, I learn something new. So I appreciate that. We had a really fun podcast a few weeks ago that was released about a smaller private equity firm that's investing in smaller firms. I was well educated on that after that podcast, and I learned a lot. It was pretty cool. We're going to do another one coming up with Alan Colton as well, where we're going to talk about some of the big deals. He just did the big one with Baker Tilly. And so we're going to talk about that. I think we're going to do that on LinkedIn Live, actually. So, yeah.
Yeah, he'll have a lot more to add to that on that large firm space. Yep. That he could really drill down on what I was just mentioning there.
Oh, yeah, the large firm space for sure. So that I think that's a great segue, because now what we really wanted to talk about today is this new model that you're putting together. I assume it's new, but that you're trademarking, is that the right term?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
As the Woodard.
We're marking it.
Yeah.
But it's called the Woodard Ideal Practice Model. And it's not new in that it's we've been kind of gestating this child that we've birthed for 5 years or so. Seven, if you want to go all the way back to the inception of our coach program. This is a maturation process, and it's matured into these seven disciplines as we have coached thousands of firms over almost a decade here. And what we have determined, Randy, is no matter what your need set is as a practitioner within the accounting profession, it can fit into one of seven different practice development objectives. So the first one is Ideal You, which is a fancy way of saying brand, but we like this better. Randy, you know full well that brand is a story. Brand's not a logo. So if you don't know who your ideal professional self is and the identity of your practice, you don't have a story to tell. So we start by that discovery. Then we help them write the story. The story becomes the brand. Okay.
Nice.
So then the logo forms out of the story or out of the brand. So when your listeners look at the Woodard logo, which they may see on your podcast page, or if they go to woodard.com, it just looks like a bunch of letters that we happen to pick a font, but there are subtleties there. There's strength in the font we picked. It's a bulwark. The entire logo looks like something you could lean against and depend on. Every letter is connected because of the networking component. We're community oriented. So, but if you start by trying to build the logo and you don't have the story yet, it's a horse cart problem. Okay. So then after you've developed your story and built your ideal you, you have your ideal service slate, which reflects the brand because the brand has a promise. For example, Disney's brand and brand promises we create happiness. Their product is a memory. Well, until they understand that, they don't even know what services they're supposed to offer. They can't possibly slate that. So these are cumulative. They build on each other. The services follow the brand. Now, once you have the brand and once you have the services, then you know the ideal client to purchase your services. For example, Disney would not try to market to somebody that isn't a person of nostalgia, that didn't grow up going to Disney World, that's a 15-year-old grown adult with no kids and with no grandkids and doesn't like chaos, who's maybe an agoraphobe. So maybe that's not the ideal customer for Disney. So once they understand their product's not for everyone, then they can actually position the product to the correct market. So if your listeners are listening and you're wondering why you always end up with these clients that don't value you, don't understand what you do, but somehow they always work their way into your practice, it's because the brand story didn't filter them. The service slate did not filter them before they ever got to that front door. Now, feel free to interrupt me at any time. I'm just rattling through all seven. Do you want me to keep going? Or
I have a question on that one then. So the client, what did you call this third client? Profiling?
The ideal client.
Ideal client. And so when you're looking at an ideal client, when you've done the branding, the story, coming up with who you are, and then the services that you're offering, does this start then funneling down to a niche when you're coming up with an ideal client, or how do you see that plan?
It's a really good question. Yes. And what I say is there are riches in the niches, but there are leashes in the niches. So be careful, right? Right. Be careful. It can limit you as much as it does help you. So what I would say is in some cases, your brand story does necessitate that you go after a particular market segment. I would say that that is not as common as maybe some of my thought leader peers have said that you need to, that it's sort of like a table stakes thing to differentiate your practice. I've got a very specific answer to this, Randy, if I could just drill down for a minute.
Yep.
I say that if you're providing services, this is the way I delineate it. I put it into accounting terms. If you're providing services below gross profit, then offer your services to any client who understands the value of the service slate and can buy into the story, meaning the vision that you have and the outcomes you're trying to drive. An example of that would be, say, controllership services. I can put in spend management services, budgets, purchase orders, spend policy enforcements, maybe some intelligent spend cards to help mitigate expense overruns. I could do that for a wide swath of businesses. Once I understand that my story is I protect small business journeys and I understand my service includes controllership, why would I limit that whenever it applies to so many businesses? The only thing I'm limiting there, Randy, is businesses where other people besides the owner are authorized to spend, because businesses don't need spend management if only the owner is authorized to spend. They might need a budget, but they don't need spend policy enforcement. So I might have other filters for ideal client that aren't niche. However, if I'm talking about services above gross profit, where I'm helping them to control costs, maybe even do some capital expenditure management, like forklifts or fleet trucks or warehouses, things like that. Definitely, if I'm trying to help them with revenue and revenue management, pricing, pricing strategies, maybe even helping them walk through their own brand story, their own service lake, their own ideal customer profile. Well, now I've started to get into pure advisory. And I think if you're going to do that, you have to have a deep understanding of the way that business operates. That's where your riches and the niches come from.
Got it.
Above gross profit.
All right. Yeah. That's a great explanation. All right. Ideal client then.
Ideal client. Now, sitting underneath the ideal client is the non-price sensitive client. That's part of the profile. And infused into the ideal service is the ideal price. So if you're wondering where pricing is underneath service. That's where we place it. Okay. Now, ideal technology is the fourth one. Once you have the brand story, the service slate, you know who you're going to be putting this in front of, the right kind of buyer, you've got to serve it out with technology. That's everything from the client experience side, which should be mobile first, all the way through to the automation layers that increase your efficiencies, profitability, and scale. Then you get into the process. Now, technology and process don't necessarily get deployed sequentially. These two are two sides of the same coin, right? And therefore, they're done more in concert with each other. As you're deploying your process, you're doing your tech as your process, they inform each other. But they both do follow ideal you, ideal services, ideal client. Then you have your ideal engagement, which is the actual mechanics of the engagement itself. How do you manage scope? How do you deal with the contractual obligations that you have? Protections is where your lawyer would get involved. Statements of work versus master services agreement. And managing client expectations, because expectation reality gaps can destroy relationships. So this is, interestingly enough, when we say ideal engagement, we don't mean pricing. What we mean is after you've set services and price and the client's ready to buy, these are more of the mechanics of the engagement itself. And we can sink the ship on this one if we're not careful. And then the final one is to build all of this through to the team. So you democratize the vision, the services, the client, the technology, the process, and the engagement structure through systems to the team under a healthy team culture, which you're talking about at Scaling New Heights, so that you can scale this through various resource strategies, some of which could be outsourcing, some of it could be permanent team members. Some of it could be a network of people that you partner with and refer to. A team can have a very broad meaning.
Yep. So a couple things, because I want to expand on it. Since I am talking about actually firm growth and how culture ties into growth, I think maybe you agree with me, maybe not, but I think
absolutely. You can't grow a firm without culture. Yep. And if you could, would you want to?
Well, it's funny. Dan Hood and I had a conversation on this, and it was a really interesting conversation because I went in with this mindset that, you know, we want to create this great culture, a culture where people feel valued and feel like they're part of something. And Dan was like, yeah, but you can actually build a firm with a culture of burnout too. And I'm like, well, I suppose you can. And there are some firms out there that do that. And you go in knowing you're going to be worked to not literally to death, but mm-hmm. you're going to be worked 80 hours a week and you're going to only last a couple of years and you're going to churn through it. And so I assume when you're talking culture, it's not that version of culture, the burnout culture.
But Randy, you really make a good point. Culture is a neutral word.
Yes.
You have good culture, you have bad culture. So yes, and sometimes we do use it always with the implication that it's a positive thing. It's important to put the word positive, healthy,
good,
conducive, right. Yes. Right? Those sorts of things. I just finished reading Elon Musk's biography, which is a fascinating read. I just couldn't put it down. There was an interesting conclusion from John Oliver, by the way. And I know I'm digressing a little bit, but it does right. speak to culture. It actually does tie back to culture and Elon Musk's management style. After John Oliver read the biography, his statement, you know how whimsical he is, his statement was, I have so much respect for everything that Elon Musk has accomplished for humanity, and I'm horrified that it is Elon Musk who is doing it. That's a funny line, right? Yeah. Well, you know, and I drive a Tesla. I don't have anything personal against Elon Musk, but I get the paradox of this. And what made me think about Elon Musk is he does a great job casting vision. So he has no problem telling the story, but the culture is a culture of burnout.
Yeah.
When you read the book,
oh yeah,
he burns people out. They last a couple of years and they're gone. So you have to be so careful that the vision is checked by a pace that is sustainable. That's huge.
Yep, perfect. And just as a side note on your Elon Musk story, a friend of mine's son worked at SpaceX down in Southern Texas, and they brought cots into the office so people could sleep in the office and so they could work more. And I'm like, man, that is not a culture that I want to be part of, but it is a culture. Then that's what you just said, that the culture, that's what they've created is that burnout culture. And they know they're going
to
have people for 2 years. So let's talk about, I'm so fascinated about culture and team in general. That, you know, we already said it, but that is what I'm going to be talking about at Scaling New Heights. Let's dig deeper into team, because that's the part, that's the one I really love. And so when we're talking team, you already said you could have an outsource, you can have internal, you can have part-time, you can have remote. I'm sure there's all these different things, but when you're looking at the team aspect of the Woodard practice model, let's expand on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a 2 week version, a 4 week version, a 10 week version. So there are three different kind of depths or peels of the onion on this one. But I'm just going to kind of surface out because it would be two or three podcasts to completely unpack everything we talk about, right?
Yep.
But I want to start by delineating when you're leading a team, there are two different words and they are not synonymous. There is management and there is leadership. And leadership is the development of people. Management is the measurement of people. And unfortunately, Randy, what I've seen in most accounting firms is we neither lead nor manage, meaning that we supervise. Yes, we supervise, but we don't measure. And if we are measuring, we don't measure what matters. We measure things, you know, like utilization, realization. I'm like, okay, not really what's going to build a culture. Instead, what we recommend over at Woodard is John Doerr's Measure What Matters, appropriate title for the book, because I think he's actually measuring what matters, and his OKR adoption, right? Objectives and key results. And then we have the people on the team help to write those objectives and key results. So they have a sense of ownership of them from the very beginning. The other thing we teach over here at Woodard, one of our bedrock principles. So first, we measure what matters. And we reward success in those areas. The second, and they're inseparable, is we delegate outcomes whenever we can. We delegate tasks only when we have to. So once we have these objectives and key results and people have bought into them and taken ownership for these outcomes, Randy, it's my job as the owner of the company to serve people to better their chances of achieving their objectives, rather than me barking orders so that they can assist me in accomplishing mine. And that's a model called servant leadership, which is not a state of mind. It's a methodology. It's not that I'm humble or something like that. It's that I have a servant leadership model, meaning that I serve the people that are on my team to drive their outcomes, which happen to be owned by my company. The outcomes are owned by my company. Now, there's a book called Servant Leadership by Hunter. I would recommend you read. So I've dropped two books here, John Doerr, Measure What Matters, and I've got Hunter's Servant Leadership. Now, a little caveat to your listeners, Hunter does come at the servant leadership model from a spiritual perspective, but most people who read the book do not feel like that's preachy. They just get to the concept underneath it, but I want to let your listeners know that so they don't think I have an ulterior motive or anything. It's just a good business book. All right, so those are two of the bedrock principles. The third bedrock principle is sustainability, which comes through several different aspects. So I've got, let's call this a drill down on sustainability of the team as a whole. One is work-life synergy. We do not like the word work-life balance because it implies there is always a compartmentalization. And in today's world, it's often best that there's not a compartmentalization unless you're on vacation in a laptop down mode. Synergizing is actually proven to be more healthy, less disruptive, not just for the business, but for the worker, except whenever you have chosen compartmentalization. So we like work-life synergy as opposed to work-life balance. The second one is the values of the company. The values of the company sustain the worker through all of the fog of war, through all of the times when they can't see clearly. And the values of a company are not the ethics or morals of a company. This is where certain companies that we've seen out in the public space, I won't mention examples, where they've crossed the line on that and they've actually disenfranchised customers from their brand story and their brand promise because they equated company values with personal moral ethics or religious mores. A value, a company value, is simply nothing more than a company behavior. I've got a third book for you. Patrick Lencioni breaks this down in his book, The Advantage. And he says there are four different kinds of company behaviors, aka values. And everybody always thinks about just having one slate. And typically it's the wrong slate. It's a slate that's kind of just PR talk, you know, like integrity first or whatever, which if that's yours, I'm not picking on you. It's just typically those are done because they make your company look good. What he would say is you have operational behaviors, you have accidental behaviors, you have aspirational behaviors. So the accidental ones are the ones that you behave and you wish you didn't. I have plenty of those in my life, right? I eat too much sugar. That's an accidental behavior. I don't exercise enough. So one of my personal values is an anti-value of exercise. That's an accidental behavior. It's not like I chose that when I was 30 and said, hey, I'm going to be against exercise or against eating well. So just understand, you know, you've got to have these goals that everybody in the company can get behind and go, okay, if we're going to aspire to have a better behavior with something like, say, racial representation, then let's all get behind it, right? And let's make sure that that matters to us or whatever it is that matters to your company. And then the fourth piece of that is coming all the way back full circle to the vision. When people are driven by the vision, but they have the guardrails of the values, they have the work-life synergy so they don't burn themselves out like the cot sleeping, or actually Elon Musk, I read in the book, slept under his desk many nights. So he practiced what he taught, but he would also burn himself out.
Yep.
And he would go through periods where he had to withdraw from his own company. So if you want to get off that roller coaster, right? So work-life synergy, you take all of those pieces together and you create something called sustainability. All of those are bedrocks of the ideal team. But there's a whole building that's built around those bedrocks. Maybe we could talk about that on a future podcast.
Oh, we could do that for sure. One question I had, because when you were talking about the values of the company and the books that you were suggesting, I was thinking in my mind, have you read Simon Sinek, The Infinite Game?
I have, The Infinite Game, yes. Which, by the way, I would tell everybody, start with why, because it helps you to get in his head better. But The Infinite Game has a lot of that in it, doesn't it?
That's what I was hearing. And I'm a huge fan of The Infinite Game. I just love that book. I have it on tape, and I'll occasionally just start playing it again because it's just so good. And just thus, I was talking to somebody, or I was introduced to somebody recently that they wanted this individual to be on the podcast, and I went to watch some of the videos that this gentleman seems like a really good guy, but he kept talking about winning and winning business and winning this. And I'm like, wait, no, this is, I already looked into Simon Sinek and how that doesn't fit into what we're doing. And so, but I am going to talk to the guy. Actually, he's really good. He just used the word differently than I would have used.
Used the word differently. Yes,
exactly.
Right. And that's where we have to be careful. And any of these things that you've heard me talk about, Randy talk about, when you come here as Breakout at Scaling, you know, you can, you're going to define things a little differently, like values equal behaviors, right? So we just have to understand that we keep our internal Google Translator on. So when other people use different words, we kind of know what they mean.
Oh, yeah.
And we know what they're trying to say.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. No, for sure.
If not, you become a little Sheldon Cooper-esque, right? You're constantly correcting people on the nuances of language. If your listeners didn't get that, that's really on them. Sorry.
No, I liked it. And I didn't even watch the show that much, but I understood what you were saying. I think I did.
He's an iconic character.
Yep,
yes.
Yep. So this is what I wanted to talk about today, this whole ideal practice model that you've got. You said it's been in the works for 7 years, but is this like a new rollout of it? Or is this like you've just got it to a point where it's like, okay, we're going forward with this?
Well, it coalesced in a way that we now find the clarity to present it as a system. So we built it from, it's like Lego block building, right? We started with a big bag of client pain points. And our clients are accounting firms, accounting firm pain points and needs. We threw them all on the table. And 7 years later, we actually built something out of all these Lego blocks, would be the way I would explain it with a metaphor. So the concepts aren't new, but they're much more focused and organized.
Yeah. Well, I think it's awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this and probably not going to interrupt you during Scaling New Heights because you're going to be pretty busy out there. But at some point in time, we'll dig deeper into this as well. And the pricing models that I think you probably have some as well, because you would mention a few times in here that I'd be curious. And just that whole where the pricing comes in before the, you know what, let's expand on that now. I got a little lost, not lost from a standpoint, but in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, you're saying the pricing model before you have the engagement structure. Can you explain that a little further to me?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because the services are what you're offering. So that would be accounting, controllership, advisory. The engagement is just the mechanics of how you're delivering that over to the customer. So it is largely, when I say mechanics, I mean just really almost the hind end of the model. It's where the lawyers get involved. It's where the legalese is infused into the master services agreements. It's the issuance of the change orders. It's all that mundane drudge stuff, which we surface up here as a separate ideal only because we've seen people wreck their ships against the rocks without it. We didn't want to bury it under services.
Got it.
So that's the answer to your question. Now, but I'll tell you what I thought you were going to ask, and I do get asked all the time is, well, this is perfect if I'm starting a brand new practice, but I already have clients, I already have services, I already have technology process, I already have engagements that are in motion. I have team members that already exist. I already have a website, whether it's telling the right story or not. So how do I take these, right? It's almost easier if I'm starting from scratch than it is if I'm trying to infuse these into an existent motion. So a couple of ways that we've addressed that. And one of them is the best way you can do it, Randy, is to create two different versions of your practice within your practice. So software companies call this Horizon 1 and Horizon 2, and then they internally disrupt themselves. So when Intuit launched QuickBooks Online, that was their Horizon 2. Their Horizon 1 was, because the one that's closest to you is your Horizon 1. So that's QuickBooks Desktop. Their Horizon 2 was QuickBooks Online. And so what Brad did is as he was bringing the next generation or the next horizon closer to him, he disrupted the one that was right in front of him. He disrupted, and they're continuing to disrupt QuickBooks Desktop. And of course, when you're talking about millions of users, it took them 20 years. If you're talking about, you know, hundreds of clients or dozens of clients, it could take you a year or two. to disrupt yourself. And then what you do is once you create your own version of your new firm, your firm 2.0, then you have a new product you can sell your existing clients. And if they choose not to buy it, that's okay. You don't fire them or anything. You don't kick them out right away, but you move them closer to the back door.
Yep.
So that when the positive pressure of all these clients buying your new better product, better for them, better for you, as that positive pressure forms into your practice, it just organically helps you walk those clients, gives you the economic courage to walk them to the back door. And then don't just kick them out the back door, help them find a new accountant, nurture them. They're humans, they're people that you value, but it's a slow bake process on this. And some people have just left that legacy practice. They just go ahead and create a bubble around it called legacy practice, and they leave it around for years. I mean, there's nothing saying you have to kill it.
Right.
QuickBooks Desktop may still be an Intuit product a decade from now. It'll just be a legacy product.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
You could do the same thing.
And do you see that, do you recommend they keep that around? I mean, is that, it seems like if you're going to disrupt, you're going to disrupt for a reason because you like this new model that you're putting together. And at some point in time, you're just not going to want to service that old model anymore. But you find some people are still continue to service that.
And they do it for noble reasons. They don't do it because it's necessarily the best business case. They do it because they've gone through the fire with this business.
Yep.
They're friends. There's a personal connection. Or maybe there are people that have worked with them and they wouldn't be where they are without them, and they want to be loyal to those team members. But the team members are not going to get on board with the 2.0 practice.
Yep.
So they actually make those legacy team members the head of the legacy division. And now the clients are happy. The people are happy. It's still a profit center. You know, so I would say, Randy, in the purest business case sense, not a smart or shrewd, I'll use the word shrewd, not a shrewd business decision. In the human sense, it's often a wise decision.
Got it. And then is there any reason or mechanics to say, hey, when we start this new model, let's start a new LLC or something as well? Or is it okay to commingle these all under one organization, or does it really matter?
I would recommend commingling, just because when you start separating out the balance sheets and you start bifurcating the team across those multiple corporates, the intercompanies, it gets unnecessarily complex. But you definitely want to make it different departments, what QuickBooks would call classes, right? Because they each need to have their own P&Ls.
Got it. All right. It makes sense. I didn't see any reason other than if you want to sell that old legacy version at some point, that's fine. You can do it.
You sell the asset. Already,
exactly. So
people buy assets anyway. Nobody buys companies, not at this level.
No,
they buy
exactly,
assets.
Exactly. Right? So, all right. Well, we can go on forever, and we will do this on the next version. We will expand on another portion of this or something else. But before we get to a couple further questions, any wrap you want to give on what we discussed?
Well, just the final thing I would say is, if you are imminently going to retire and you're interested in this M&A thing that's coming up over the next 5 years, then you may not need all seven. I would focus on services, I would focus on client, and I would focus on engagement, because whoever buys you is going to have their own brand, their own process, their own team, and their own technology. So focus on tightening up engagement legalities and engagement letters. Have a good service slate priced right. Have a good slate of clients that somebody would want to adopt and take good care of, and you'll position yourself well to sell that book of business. So that's kind of to tie it back to the first thing we talked about.
Yeah, and that's cool too, because what people can look at things like this and the seven-step process or seven things they need to do and start to get overwhelmed. And you can start with one or two, or even only implement one or two, especially depending on what your future holds. I love that.
There is joy in this journey, Randy, and it does take years, but you start making more money, you start having more fun as you go.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. So a couple final things then. And you and I talked about this last time, but every guest gets this question, and I don't remember your answer from last time. And we'll see if you recall or if you have a new one this time. But big fan of culture and people, and the people are more than their job title. So I always like to ask the question is, you know, when you're not out educating and helping the profession, what are your outside of work passions? What do you love to do that's not work related?
Well, right now, it's 100% about being a dad. So I'm my daughter's dad. And that may be a little bit different answer because we haven't talked in so long. And she was more like, I was still my daughter's dad, but now it's a full-time job. Volleyball, travel ball. I just got back from Orlando yesterday for a 3-day tournament. just the coaching you have to do for a 16-year-old girl at all in any age of humanity, but in today's world, social media and all this other stuff going on, I feel like I'm a full-time life coach to my daughter and also protector, you know, not yeah. overprotect, but, you know, she's my daughter. You don't mess with her. So right now, that's my answer. Now, after she's successfully off at college and settled into her dorm room and exceeding at life and checking in on me with me every Sunday or so, I may have a different answer for you. I may get to play golf again. I don't know.
Well, that's
right
nice.
Right now, it's her.
And that's one thing that my wife and I miss is one of our sons was a volleyball player. Mm. And it was, you know, and I'm sure the same with you, is, you know, 10, 11 months a year, pretty much nonstop volleyball. You got school, you got travel, you got club, you got all the stuff. And that was so much fun just to have that moment in time. You are enjoying it, but my advice is don't take it for granted because it is such a cool time.
Thank you for that, Randy. Good advice.
All right. And then last thing. So we mentioned a couple things. We mentioned Scaling New Height a couple times. That is coming up in June in Orlando. Do you have the dates?
Yes, it's the 16th through the 19th of June. That's a Sunday through a Wednesday. It's going to be at the Orlando World Center Marriott, Marriott's largest hotel and convention center in the world. We're going to consume that place. It's going to be, like you said, it's one of the three largest conferences in the country. It's the largest technology exhibit floor in the country, specific to accounting technology. So it's a very specific bragging point, but we like it.
Yeah, that's very nice.
So if you want to come explore accounting technology, that would be the place, 150 exhibits, over 100 breakouts, one of which is Randy here talking about team. So make sure you catch that culture and how those are integral to growth. And that's, you can find out more about that at mylastname.com. So WOODARD.com. If you put the second W in there, I don't know where it goes.
Right.
It's not Woodward, it's Woodard.
Woodard.
Yes, absolutely.
Woodard. And we will have that in the show notes and a link to Scaling New Heights as well. And looking forward to seeing you there and enjoying Orlando for a handful of days in June. Should be a good time.
Yeah, we're going to have a good time.
I want to thank you for being on the show again. It's always a pleasure and look forward to the next time.
Yeah, have me back anytime, Randy. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on The Unique CPA. You can find the show notes for today's episode and learn more about TriMerit at theuniquecpa.com. Remember to subscribe and leave a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting app. And join us next time for more expertise and insights on The Unique CPA. ProfessionalProductions.net.